John Ehrlichman was graduated from UCLA and Stanford and served as lead navigator in the 8th Air Force in Europe. He was White House counsel, then became assistant to the president for domestic affairs in late 1969. For many years, he has lived and practiced law in Seattle, Washington. The Company was written in an old adobe house in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
You're a good reader. John Ehrlichman, reading the description of John Ehrlichman that appears on the dust jacket of his new novel, The Company. Is that, Mr. Ehrlichman, a complete description of you? Have there not been certain omissions in that description?
Oh, well, the page wasn't big enough for a complete description.
There's no mention of Watergate in there, though.
No mention of Watergate. No mention of my vegetable garden. No mention of my kids. You know, all kinds of things left out that are important to me, but that was what was important to the publisher, I guess.
You didn't have any say over it?
No.
But it occurs to me that if somebody who'd been living in outer space, say, for the last 4 years, came and picked up that book and read that description of John Ehrlichman, they would really miss what, to most of us living in this country, is the kernel of your life, what has become the central focus of your life, and that is your association with the Nixon White House. That name Nixon doesn't even appear on the dust jacket.
I guess they figure not too many people from outer space are going to wander into the bookstores this week. And I guess everybody else knows that.
What is your legal status right now?
I have a couple of cases on appeal, and I have about a half a dozen civil cases in various stages of getting ready, down from a total of about 16 at one time. The others all having been thrown out at one time or another.
Haven't you exhausted your appeals in the Ellsberg case?
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are you free to talk about Watergate?
I'm admonished by attorneys and by the realities of the situation not to talk about the issues of those cases, because one of the grounds of our appeal is that it was impossible to get a fair trial in view of all of the pretrial publicity. Now, obviously, I can't be complaining about pretrial publicity on the one hand and contributing to it in the event of a new trial on the other. So I just don't talk about those things.
You are talking about your novel, a book which your publisher gave you, was it $50,000 advance on?
Well, yes. I ordinarily don't talk about my financial affairs either, since I'm no longer in public life.
You have spoken to some folks about it, because I did some homework and read that...
Well, no, I think they got that from the publisher, as a matter of fact.
Is that so?
Yeah.
But I also read that you're something like $400,000 in debt with legal fees.
They didn't get
that
from anybody, because...
That's not true?
No, I'm sure that's not accurate. I never try and estimate a number. I'm sure the lawyers don't, mm-hmm. and they would be it would be one or the other of us, but... As you know, that doesn't stop people from writing things.
Well, I wondered, though, yeah. But I wondered why you decided to write a novel. Is it obviously for economic reasons?
No, I had, matter of fact, I had written the rough outlines of the book before I had incurred those obligations, and had a thriving private practice at the time. So it was very much a sideline.
Mm-hmm. But now you're disbarred, so you really...
Well, that's all transpired since, but you asked what my motives were, and back in that time, I started out to write a mystery story, and the central thread of it was going to be that the director of the CIA was going to try and rig a presidential election. And that thread still exists in the story, but obviously the story has become much more... in its final development.
Why a novel and not memoirs?
Well, for a couple of reasons. I'm not in any shape to write memoirs, even assuming that I decide to do so, which I haven't decided. I'm not in any shape to do it because of the lawsuits, and also because the federal government has all my files and diaries and the notes of all my conversations with the president locked up, and I can't get at them. Anything that I did of a nonfiction nature, I would want to have as accurate as possible. I haven't really decided whether to do that or not. I don't know just how much I'm going to be able to contribute.
Well, you have chosen fiction, and you've chosen to written about the CIA and foreign affairs as opposed to your old specialty of domestic affairs. Why?
Oh, it lends itself to a thriller. To an adventure story or a mystery, I think better. I probably could have written real shocker about a struggle between bureaucracies over the question of adding three more GS-14s.
That is a shocker.
But
gives me shivers just thinking about that plot.
I decided not to.
Well, you have written a shocker. You've written a shocker about a president of the United States who gave direct orders for the murder of a foreign leader.
Three presidents, actually. I very deliberately laid the plot over three different administrations because I didn't want to lend myself to the suggestion that these problems in government somehow crop up in one administration and are exclusive to that one administration.
Why was it important for you to write that?
Well, because I think it's very misleading.
Is that what happened with Watergate? Is that what happened with the public perception of the Nixon administration?
Oh, I think there are a lot of stereotypes that are carried with it, but I wouldn't oversimplify it by agreeing with your question.
Mm-hmm. Why should we read this book, Mr. Ehrlichman?
Oh, I hope you read it for entertainment.
About your characters, you seem to give them a cynicism, super cynicism, that has just about everyone in your book running around protecting a career, advancing his own ambitions. If these are not thinly disguised characters, but rather people who bear the same characteristics as people you might have known, they are portrayed as anything from fools and martinets to crooks. And I'm wondering if you feel any contempt or bitterness about the people that
In real life? No, I really don't. I really don't. I have none of that as to the people that I formerly worked with. Haldeman, I still consider a friend. I don't have any occasion to see any of these folks anymore.
You talk to them on the phone?
Scattered around in different towns. I have talked to them on occasion when there's been something to talk about. I haven't talked to Mr. Nixon for many years, but I don't have any sense of animosity or resentment.
Any regrets for having taken part in this?
Oh, of course. You can't help but have regrets.
You wish you hadn't come to Washington?
Well, you get a sort of a feeling like after you've been in the Army, as I was, and been to combat and seen a lot of things that were hard to take, and you come back and you think, well, that's an experience I would rather not have had. But at the same time, there are a lot of valuable things in it. And I have a feeling that I was able to make some real affirmative contributions, particularly in the area of domestic policy, domestic problem solving, and I don't really regret that aspect of it at all. But at the same time, you can't be associated with a flawed enterprise without looking back on it and wondering if there weren't times or occasions where if you'd been smarter or more alert or better in some way that you might not have prevented the disaster from occurring.
You feel that Nixon misused you, though. You've said that.
That gets into the area of these lawsuits that I just really don't want to get into here.
Why don't you bear any animosity? It seems to me it's totally human to be damn mad.
I had a lot of problems when I first came out of these trials, but it seems to me that there is no more corrosive and self-defeating emotion than resentment and hatred. And I finally realized that I simply could not pack that around with me, that it would eat me up. And so I have done a lot of thinking, I've done a lot of praying, I've done a lot of living in an effort to drop that out of my being.
You don't have the...
I think it's very important for me to do, and I'm very grateful for the extent to which I have been able to do it.
You don't have that feeling of twisting slowly, slowly in the wind?
No, I really don't.
Mr. Ehrlichman, if Watergate hadn't happened, and I suppose by that I mean if the burglars hadn't been caught, what would you be doing today?
I have no idea. I'd probably be trying to figure out how to get away for the 4th of July weekend and get all my work done and all that. I would not have had the chance to read or think or fish or sketch or do the other things that I've done. I'd not know my children as I know them, nor would they know me. And I think I'd be a net loser.
What an extraordinary statement. You'd also be part of an administration which would be prepared
to make its graceful exit
from Washington?
I'd be long gone. I was ready to leave. And I had agreed to stay a short time after the election. But I'd be long gone from Washington. I'd probably be in practicing law or
practicing
in business
law.
Or, you know, there's no telling where I'd be in those terms. But I doubt seriously that I would have had the courage to reconstruct my life along the lines that I really, in my heart, would like to have reconstructed it. And the being blown out of it has given me the opportunity that I probably would not have taken on my own. There's been another aspect to it, which through a whole series of chance events has brought me in touch with a lot of people who think that I can help them in some way.
The Indians?
No, Indians, Anglos, Spanish, Chicanos, all kinds of people. And so it's given me a chance to get to know some of these people. It's given me a chance to take a measure of their problems and what they mean in terms of what society really is like, what our society is doing to them, what problems we all share now in trying to cope, how badly government is delivering for us, for instance. I just wish that I had had those kinds of experiences before I came to Washington rather than after, because I think I'd have done, you know, an immeasurably better job.
What do you think of the current political situation? How are folks doing?
Well, I've decided that the best thing I can do for a candidate is not mention his name.
I wonder. I was thinking about that this morning. Would an Ehrlichman endorsement be the kiss of death?
I may go up and campaign for Lowell Weicker. I don't know.
Has he invited you?
Far from it.
He might pay you to stay out of his state.
Probably. I could make a nice living.
That's another thing I wanted to know. One of Lowell Weicker's former neighbors. I didn't see John Dean in this book. Was there a John Dean and I missed him?
Oh, I don't think so. No. No, I didn't. I haven't thought about John Dean very much.
You're kidding.
No, I really haven't. And it certainly didn't occur to me to write him into this book.
Mr. Ehrlichman, I wonder, when you drive up to a gas station or go into the laundromat in Santa Fe, if that's what you do, if that's how you do your housekeeping, and you see a stranger, and he or she suddenly comes to realize who you are, what kind of reaction do you get?
Friendly.
Yeah?
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they ask questions.
What kinds of things? What are the most common questions?
Well, I don't think there's any one thing. I had a couple of young guys come up to me in a restaurant. I was at my daughter's college a while back, came up in a restaurant and said, "Hey, who's Deep Throat?" You know.
Did you answer? Do you know?
Oh, no. Don't know, don't care.
Oh, you ought to care.
Why? No, people are really nice, really friendly, and I've met some, you know, terrific people that way.
Sympathetic towards you, sympathetic to your situation.
Generally speaking,
feeling somewhere
no
this guy was
involved
in taking our democracy away.
No, I think the only hostility would be in a totally safe situation where they didn't have to face me. You know, if they could make an anonymous phone call or something, maybe there'd be some of that. There was some guy in California who wrote me hate mail for a while. And it was kind of funny because he had written me before and put his return address on, his name and return address. He wrote me a letter. And then when the hate mail started to come, it was anonymous.
But you recognize
But it was obvious that it was the same guy.
Uh-huh.
And so I just wrote him a letter and said, you know, please don't write me this kind of stuff. It's not worthy of you. He was a doctor. It was just not worthy of you, and it's certainly disturbing to me.
Why do you think he did it?
Well, I don't know. He was getting some sort of psychic release? The same reason you boo the umpire at baseball games, I suppose. I don't know why people engage in that kind of thing. It's kind of sick.
Do you sense, though, that there really might be a tremendous public resentment towards you, towards the people who were that deeply involved?
No, I think that this is much sharper in the minds of people in Washington than it is in the real country.
Is that so?
Yeah.
This
folks,
is something that you all sensed while you were here. That's interesting that you're now confirming your own suspicion.
Folks in the country, you know, think that the people in Washington are out of touch.
Mm-hmm.
And they're right.
About Watergate?
About everything.
Well, you're not saying that the people beyond Washington, D.C. don't consider Watergate a big deal. I mean, you're not implying that it was a small matter to the rest of the country.
No, but at this point, it's pretty much a dead letter around the country, at least in the contacts that I have. And people can't understand why you all here are still beating a dead horse.
What do you pick up in the course of talking with folks to be their definition of what Watergate was?
Well, I think a lot of them recognize it as being a part of a whole rather than an isolated incident, and that it's not too much different from what has gone on before and continues to go on in the abuse of power, in misleading people, and so on. They know they're misled.
And if it was part of a continuum, why then did it get so much public attention? Why then did it lead to the resignation of one president when many might have been in similar situations?
I don't know the whole answer to that. Part of it is, I think, as Bryce Harlow said the other day, that the Congress was of one party and the White House of another. The things that went on in the Johnson administration that were not made huge celebrated causes are at least partly explained by that, and possibly the Kennedy situation the same, and possibly the Truman situation the same. And then you have a coincidence of partisan identification in the White House and the Congress there. Secondly, I think this was the first one in the media age, and I think the Irvin hearings, almost to the exclusion of every other factor, set the climate and prepared the skids, so to speak, for the president's resignation. Without that prolonged, intensive media attention, without that preparation, and without the obvious mistakes that the White House made in response to it, for an organization that supposedly understood the media, I think the people in the White House, myself included, underestimated that whole process terrifically in its impact and importance. But without that, I think it would have been a very reticent Congress and a very reticent people, unprepared to turn a president out. So, and then there are undoubtedly all the other things, the climate in the city created by the two newspapers and particularly the Post and so on. And all of these things undoubtedly contributed in their way. So it's a mixed and complex answer that I would have to give to your question, and a very incomplete one because I haven't really thought it through.
I must say that I find myself in just trying to think what Watergate was, having an awfully hard time.
Well, it was a media event, among other things.
Well, yeah, and it was
not exclusively.
It was a kind of carefully charted tampering, essentially, with the ballot of every American, American cast.
And,
I mean, I don't know, you know, which to pick of what seems to me an octopus of...
You know, having sat there on sort of the other side of the screen, people make political speeches and say these fellows were trying to steal the Constitution or they were trying to steal the country or so on, it's very hard for me to equate what actually took place and what I heard going on with those kinds of rhetorical charges. I mean, there's just nothing like that in anybody's mind. If it comes down to a question of subjectivity.
You mean in a premeditated way?
Well, either premeditated or...
Hey, guys, let's all get together today and steal everybody's constitutional rights.
Or even... the people be damned. I mean, there wasn't even any of that. Which would have been, I don't mean to denigrate that, that's been pretty bad too. It was very much a day-to-day dealing with pragmatic problems of that seemed to be a part of a continuing battle between the White House and the media. And there were probably 1,000 failed attacks on the White House that had been successfully blunted in one way or another by quick admission of wrongdoing or by firing somebody or by a change of tactics or by media response or whatever. And this one took. The committee to reelect could have been reorganized quickly, and people responsible could have been fired and punished, and the White House could have survived it very nicely. But it was by clutching the mistake to its bosom and by trying to deal with it as just another partisan attack that the problem was so severely aggravated.
Was the mistake one of wrongdoing or in letting it get out?
Well, the mistake, obviously, was in how the wrongdoing was responded to, as I see it. That's what brought the president down. If you'd gone out quickly, if one had gone out quickly and said, this was terribly wrong, and these people ought to be punished, and the campaign managers responsible ought to be fired, and we're going to clean house over there and set up a new campaign organization, I think that had been the end of it.